I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana, an innovative collaboration that aims to move the Hoosier State out of the bottom region of the health and wellness charts. We'll be talking with three fundamental players in the collaboration: Doug Leonard, president of the Indiana Hospital Association; Mike Ripley, vice president for healthcare policy for the Indiana Chamber of Commerce; and Julie Reed, executive vice president for the Indiana State Medical Association. Please join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana today on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Doug Leonard, who is president of the Indiana Hospital Association; Mike Ripley, who is vice president for healthcare policy for the Indiana Chamber of Commerce; and Julie Reed, who is executive vice president for the Indiana State Medical Association. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
It's good to have you here. Good of you to brave the cold and come in and see us.
Nice to be here.
So we probably ought to start here by talking about what the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana is, what it looks like, how it works, and then we will back into the circumstances that brought it about. Doug, I'll start with you on that one.
Sure. The Alliance is it's a group of concerned organizations and individuals that have come together. The story goes back to last year, our chairman of the Hospital Association Board, who had just stepped into his role, Brian Mills, sort of challenged the hospital leaders in the state to say, it's time that we did something about the terrible health factors in Indiana. And he got such a positive response across the state to that we started forming together a small group of committed leaders. So that's the State Chamber of Commerce, the State Medical Association, the Fairbanks School of Public Health, the Fairbanks Foundation, Anthem, and we've come together first to consider, does this idea make sense? Is it the right time? How do we go about it? And then little by little, kind of shopping that challenge with other leaders in the state and policymakers and others involved in some of these things. And the real theory behind this is that by any measure and with every report that comes out nationally, Indiana has ranked in the bottom of health measures, whether it's obesity, smoking, infant mortality, et cetera. And it's a shameful position that we're in. And our thought is that if we do nothing different than we've done in the past, we'll be there 20 years from now or 30 years from now. And some of these issues, it may take a generation of initiatives and actions to change. But if we don't draw the line in the sand someplace and start, then we'll never make a difference in that.
Julie, how did this coalition or collaboration, how did you decide who the partners were going to be at the table?
Sure. Well, we were really appreciative when Brian Mills reached out when he took over his leadership role at the Hospital Association and suggested that we really ought to all find a way to work together on this. And I think for us, it was really simple. I mean, it was, let's make sure that we get together some of the large groups that have a key voice in healthcare in the state of Indiana, like the Hospital Association and the State Medical Association. Let's get our industry partners and the employer base with the chamber involved. Let's get the major payer in the state of Indiana, Anthem, involved, and then let's make sure we've got the right data to enforce it, which the Fairbanks School of Public Health and the Fairbanks Foundation have helped do. So it really, to us, just fit really nicely and has been a great synergy of groups.
And, Mike, I'm assuming that part of the reason you're here is because, and we're going to talk about these dismal numbers and how we got to them and what we can do about them later, but because there is – an effect on the state's economy by ranking in these categories, and there's a reason for business to care.
Yeah, we put together in 2010 a plan of action called our Chamber Vision 2025, where we looked at various drivers that were specific to making business better in Indiana. And one of those was related to attractive business climate. And particularly a couple of the points under the attractive business climate are smoking and obesity, because those issues are costly for employers. And so we had set some goals related to obesity and smoking. And so the issue of smoking has been on our radar quite a bit, and we'll talk about numbers a little bit later. But my boss then was invited, because of our 2025 goals, was invited to participate in this. And the issue is really extremely important to employers.
Do you have numbers, Mike, as to how much, the fact that we rank near the bottom on a lot of these things costs us as a state?
Yeah, we've been looking at the number. When it comes to overall health, we're ranked either 41st or 42nd in the country, and that's pretty dismal. When it comes to smoking, our goals are we would like by 2025 to get our population down to 15% smoking, and we're about 20. We were at 25, and then we dropped a little bit, and we've cranked back up. We're about right at about 23% right now. But smoking cost employers in Indiana, between medical costs and then absenteeism and production costs, about $6 billion a year.
$6 billion per year?
Yes.
How about obesity and the other costs? Have you broken those down?
We have not. We're focusing right now. The thing is, what we thought was most important was to get the issue that we knew that we could deal with, and that is smoking. That seems to be the biggest number issue. And so we're working on that first, and then we're going to try to tackle the obesity afterwards. But our goal's here to address smoking.
We are talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana today on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Doug, now that we've pulled all of these folks together, what are they going to do?
Well, importantly, first, we wanted to talk about the overall goal is sort of the umbrella of this initiative, and that's really looking at what we can do about tackling tobacco use, battling opioid abuse, taking on obesity, as Mike said, reducing infant mortality. And after considering all those things, we decided that our first real initiative, the first constructive actions, would be related to tobacco. And we picked tobacco for a couple of reasons. One is the cost that Mike already indicated, but also tobacco is a contributing factor to every one of those other conditions. Every person addicted to opioids also smokes. The smoking contributes as one of the leading indicators for infant mortality. So, and not to mention cancer and other conditions, emphysema, whatever. So that's one thing, is that the importance of tobacco is the product itself. Secondly is that when you look across the country, the initiatives to reduce tobacco are more evidence-based than some of the other areas. So raising the age, raising the price of the pack, et cetera, those initiatives together have been tested and implemented in different places and have science behind them in terms of the action resulting in a reduction in either starting tobacco usage or reducing it.
So tobacco is the priority. Julia, what sorts of things are we going to try then to combat tobacco use in the state?
Sure. As we know, smoking is the leading cause of preventable death in the United States. So as Doug mentioned, it really was a really logical starting point for us. Some of the evidence-based strategies that we have seen work around the country and other states and other municipalities have been strategies like raising the tax. We know there is a direct effect between raising the tax and the smoking rates. As the tax goes up, smoking rates go down. It has been time-tested in other municipalities and other states. As you raise that tax and as you drive people to stop smoking, you need to make sure you have solutions in place to help them with their addiction challenges, so you don't just have them stop cold turkey. You've got to make sure that that funding stream that you create with the tax increase goes to tobacco prevention and cessation strategies. So you've got a new funding stream, and you make sure you spend it wisely on health-related issues, including prevention and cessation. And then going along with that, one of the other strategies we've seen work in several other places across the country has been raising the age for smoking to 21. We know that that's done already in other areas like alcohol. In the communities that have done that, it's been successful. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is it comes as no surprise that the brains of adolescents are not fully mature yet at age 18 biologically. So if you wait till 21, their brains are more fully developed. The addiction potential is higher the younger they are. So the longer you wait, the lower addiction risk that there is. We also know that as you raise the age, it removes them from that social peer group. So 15-year-olds are likely to hang around with 18-year-olds, but they're not likely to hang around with 21-year-olds. So as you raise that age, it removes them from that peer group where they're going to get access to that tobacco. So there's a lot of reasons why raising the age for those groups has been a good strategy. And then finally, in an issue that I know that Mike's group has been really passionate about is repealing the preferential treatment for smokers, which has been a big issue for employers.
Mike, I do want to talk about this because politically, dealing with tobacco and smoking in Indiana has always been problematic, because we don't think of ourselves, or the rest of the country doesn't think of us as a tobacco state, but we have had a fair bit of tobacco business down in southern Indiana, which always made it difficult for state government to grapple with. What has changed about that, if anything?
Well, as far as that goes, that hasn't changed that much. But employers are, as we have had discussions among our policy members of the Indiana Chamber, the issue is really financial. The costs associated with smoking Julie and Doug have already indicated the connections to all the things that smoking does. But the issue is that employers are footing the cost for health care. Notwithstanding the Affordable Care Act, the costs have been going up. And some of it is tied to smoking. And so you've got issues there. And we think that particularly related to the preferential treatment, that ought to be an option for employers.
Probably ought to define what preferential treatment.
Currently, under Indiana statute, smokers, if you smoke in Indiana, you have basically the right to smoke. And as an employer, I cannot discriminate against you because you smoke. You have basically the same standards that you would have, like related to discrimination on race, gender, and religion. Smokers have that same elevated right, with the exception of we're allowed to financially incentivize. What we would like to see is the ability. It is a right for a person in Indiana to smoke. It's not to their betterment, but it is their right. It ought to be the right, since we're footing the bill or paying the bills for health care costs, employer-provided health insurance. We think that we ought to be able to screen and take a look at more specifically those folks that come in and work for us, whether or not they smoke and have some say-so in that decision-making process.
How likely is it, do you think, that you'll be able to get the age raised to 21, for example? And will there be teeth behind the law? Because that's always been one of the problems. Even any age limit we've got, there really isn't much more than a tisk-tisk associated with buying a pack of cigarettes if you're underage.
Well, I know that there's going to be pushback. There's going to be pushback from legislators. There are some folks out there, even some of our members are, while we have generally put a policy that we want to see it move to age 21, there will be some employers that will be impacted by it and don't want to see it raised to that much. So there's going to be some pushback to how successful we are yet. I'll let one of the other two comment.
I think historical perspective helps, because I remember as a kid, I grew up in a family of smokers, and my mom would give me a quarter and I'd go to the cigarette machine down on the corner and get her pack of cigarettes. So we no longer have those machines. There was pushback at the time and question about whether it'd be effective. So, you know, this is part of the stream of trying to address these issues. And any one action in and of itself isn't the magic bullet. But we're at a point where I think if we sort of lock arms and say we're just going to start going in this direction now, then we can make some progress that we wouldn't make if we just let things sit the way they are.
We are talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Doug Leonard, President of the Indiana Hospital Association, Mike Ripley, Vice President of Healthcare Policy for the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Julie Reed, Executive Vice President for the Indiana State Medical Association. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Andy has done and send us an email. Andy writes, and our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Andy writes, is it important to get Blue Cross Anthem on board to discuss their exit from Hoosier HealthWise? And I should say that my guests are Doug Leonard, who is president of the Indiana Hospital Association, Mike Ripley, who is vice president of healthcare policy for the Indiana Chamber, and Julie Reed, who is executive vice president for the Indiana State Medical Association. I picked on Doug first last time, so I'm going to go with Mike this time.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, Andy writes, is it important to get Blue Cross Anthem on board to discuss their exit from Hoosier HealthWise?
I wouldn't want to Anthem is a member of the Indiana Chamber, and I wouldn't want to comment on decisions that Anthem has made. But I know that they've been involved in both HIP 2.0 and providing policies for in the private sector, both commercially and then also in the public sector. But I think probably somebody from Anthem would really have to comment specifically on that, and I would not want to step into it and say something that
I see Doug wanting to jump in. So
yeah, we'll say that Anthem has – we invited Anthem in right at the outset of this creation of the alliance, and they have been an active participant in it. So as Mike said, I don't know how that's influenced by their business decisions, which insurances to offer or not, but in fact they have played an active role in the alliance to date.
We are talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Larry has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Larry, welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thank you for taking the call.
Certainly.
You know, I've been listening to the objective of this panel to improve health in the state of Indiana. But it's a known fact, at least nationwide, that one of the leading causes of death, matter of fact, from what I've read and what I've heard, is the third leading cause of death is medical malpractice or medical mistakes. And in the state of Indiana, it is impossible to bring a lawsuit against a doctor. The law, in essence, invites less than good doctors to come into this state and practice medicine because they know that they will never be sued. So is that on the agenda to work on that program?
I'll ask the question. Thanks very much for the call, Larry, and the question. Julie.
Sure. Larry, thanks for your question. I can tell you a couple of the things that we do at the State Medical Association to monitor how the industry works. One of them is that we attend the monthly medical licensing board meetings where we will see physicians who are disciplined for various conduct-related, including sometimes malpractice, cases against them. So that board always is diligent in its efforts to make sure that it's protecting the public in taking disciplinary actions. when it needs to. We also monitor closely all of the malpractice cases that do get filed in the state, and there are cases that get filed all the time. In fact, there's a free review process that exists through the Indiana Department of Insurance where patients who do not even have to be represented by counsel can file those complaints with the state and get a group of three physicians to review that case, in essence, at no fee. So there actually is a reviewing process for these cases that exists. Of course, there are times that those cases happen, but there are procedures available to handle those when they occur.
Doug.
I would add, too, from the hospital standpoint, that there's an active, ongoing, very intense effort in every hospital, and it's something the association supports with all the hospitals on reducing the likelihood of error or injury to patients. But importantly to know, too, is that this focus that we're talking about today isn't being done at the exclusion of other initiatives, because there are many other things that happen simultaneously to try to improve the health of the people in Indiana. Every hospital, for example, in their communities has a community health plan where they're taking initiatives on a number of health-related issues. And so there's an ongoing effort. This focal point right now is really trying to say, how do we align to make a bigger difference on those health factors across the state collectively to make a difference?
We've gotten a question via Facebook from our regular listener, Gary. If you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Gary writes, I have a question about what costs the employer more, a person with a disability or one who smokes? Employers can ask, do you have a disability but will not be discriminated against because of disclosure? Then what is wrong with not discriminating against someone who smokes? I'll start that with Mike, and then I've got a follow-up that I think I want to throw to all three of you, because it's going to get to an issue I know that concerns people.
Well, from a financial standpoint, ultimately, smoking is the biggest driver among healthcare costs. We think that from an employer perspective, the employer ought to be able to, at least on an interview, ask the question, do you smoke, and then make a decision accordingly by requiring maybe cessation, as opposed to – and under current law, you can incentivize for cessation, but you can't require it. So we think that it is a benefit to employers to be able to ask, screen if an employee smokes, and I think it's financially better for employers.
Well, and a question that is the follow-up, it's one that we often hear when we talk about these things, is sort of the level of engagement or involvement in what people view as their personal choices. I think there's been an internet joke that's floated around about, you know, when you call to order for a pizza or whatever, you're screened and they tell you, no, you can't have extra cheese or meat or anything like that. And the objection is that this is overreaching, really, not just on the part of government, but also on the part of employers. How do you address that question? Doug's actually the one making eye contact with me, so I'm going to let him have that one first.
That'll teach me to make eye contact. I think that's always central to this debate. You know, I was involved when I was a hospital administrator in the community where I lived in passing a smoking ban in restaurants and schools and restaurants and bars, et cetera. And the emotional responses that are brought out from smokers and people who were sort of a more libertarian nature, mm-hmm. that you shouldn't pass any rule that will interfere with my ability to do something, is always very passionate, very emotional. But in fact, as Mike started out earlier today, the cost of that choice of smoking is being borne by others. It isn't just the person who's paying for the pack of cigarettes. It's the company that's paying for the associated cancer and emphysema and other productivity issues that come from that. It's the healthcare system that's bearing the cost of those diseases and passing those on to the employers, the individuals. So it isn't just a small personal choice that only affects a person's making the choice. It's something that affects all of us. And in fact, you know, as we're recognizing in here, It also, the absence of dealing with these issues on a statewide basis creates, it leaves Indiana with a reputation that makes it unpalatable for the talent to move here, and when they see what an unhealthy state this is and how little we're doing to address it.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Ben. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Ben writes, is there any data to show how much revenue Indiana pulls from the tobacco tax and how much of that revenue, if any, goes toward funding anti-tobacco initiatives? Are there any laws that the state of Indiana must use revenue from the tobacco tax to fund those anti-tobacco programs? Mike, you probably would be the one most versed on this.
The tobacco tax at a buck a pack brings in about $240 million. I think if, as we're talking about, we're pushing for a dollar and a half, and that would be about somewhere in the ballpark of about $300 million. The state has previously, they were several years ago funding cessation at about $35 million, and that's been cut to about $5 million now. So that's not really even close to where the CDC recommends. We can be doing better and want to get it back up to the $35 million level. But there's no requirements, to my knowledge, that requires that money, that any of the cigarette tax has to be used for cessation.
Julie, I see you shaking your head. It sounds like, from your perspective, is $35 million enough out of that $240 to $300 million?
Well, we think it's a good start. At a minimum, that takes us back to the levels we were at in roughly 2001. We know that we need to put more money towards the efforts, and we need to use evidence-based strategies. So it's a good start. Will we decide later that maybe we need more of it to go to that? Possibly, but we always have to be prudent with our resources. We're always going to be resource-constrained, so we've got to be careful about how we use them. And we also have to be judicious. You know, you don't just throw a whole lot of money at something if you don't have a plan for it. You've got to make sure – sometimes you've got to start slowly and build up. And we may find, after we get started with $35 million, we may need a little bit more, but that's appropriate as we build the infrastructure of programs around the state. We have about only 36 counties in the state that have tobacco prevention and cessation programs in place of the 92. So we have a long ways to go to making sure we're reaching all corners of the state.
So a simple question. If we're collecting $240 to $300 million in taxes and only spending $5 million currently, down from 35, where is the rest of that money going, Mike?
Well, part of the under the current, where they're getting 99.5% or 0.995 per pack, and some of that goes to supporting Medicaid, HIP program, and we are hoping that some of that would, from a chamber's perspective, we think that any increase ought to be doing that. Now, that brings up a whole new discussion for this upcoming session. There will be a bill. I know that Representative Soliday has introduced legislation and did so last year that would use the cigarette tax to pay for road funding. So that's a whole nother issue, and that gets us off our main focus here today. Mm-hmm. But there are some things that will be coming up in terms of revenue on how those will be used, and that will be determined by the legislature.
We are talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Eric has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to connect this conversation to a broader topic of public health. Really, we're talking about prevention, not treatment. And when we talk about public health, we should really think about the way that our state invests in public health. And what you'll find is that per capita, Indiana ranks 47th in HRSA public health dollars, 49th in CDC, and 46th in state expenditures around public health initiatives. So when we think about our overall health ranking of 40th, 41st, 42nd in the nation, we're actually doing pretty well considering how little money we're spending. I was wondering if the panel would care to comment on the state of public health investment in terms of public dollars in Indiana, and what are some of the barriers and opportunities we might find.
I saw Julie's head bobbing up and down while you were talking, so I'm going to throw that one first to her.
Thank you. And I know I might even start with you, Doug. I know you've spent a lot of time on some work on some public health initiatives at the State Department of Health and have a sense of kind of some of the initiatives that are underway already that might serve as a good example here.
Yeah, I think the caller's making a really profound point because one of the issues that confounds our any effort to address this these issues statewide is our poor funding of the public health system in Indiana. And we've heard that recently in a report by the Fairbanks School of Public Health. They've commented on it. So part of our hope is that funding that comes from this or any other attention on this issue should go to really take a hard look at our public health systems in the state to do what the caller recommended, not only in prevention but in treatment and policy and all the activities necessary. I'm involved with the – I co-chair with the Commissioner of Health, Dr. Adams, the a council on initiatives to prevent infant mortality. And it really is amazing to see when you take one issue like that and take a comprehensive look at what kind of data do we have, what are differences culturally, what's different around the state, what strategies you can follow to address that. It's a very complex issue. This year or last year, fortunately, the state legislature passed a funding bill called the Safety Pins Bill that created funds for innovation and initiatives to address infant mortality. So I thought that was a very good way for the legislature to start to address one of these very profound problems we have in protecting our most vulnerable babies.
Probably ought to ask at this point. I mean, given that these numbers are pretty dismal and there seems to be some correlation between our public investment in health and where we are, how did we get to this point? You know, presumably all states sort of start at the same point and then make choices that lead them to this. What were the choices we made that put us in this position? Doug?
If you're asking about the choices that brought us to this point of funding public health, I mean, there's probably some, you know, history there. But if it's really the question of how did we come to have these bad sort of measures of our health, then I think there are a lot of issues that factor in there. You know, we are an agricultural, sedentary state. We're not Oregon or California or Colorado where there's a culture of activity, a culture of, you know, running and biking and that sort of thing. You know, we haven't made good investments in our cities in terms of bike lanes, safe routes for walking to school, a lot of issues like that. And I think, you know, one of the important things of going at this in a comprehensive way is, you know, this is a time for everybody, the policymakers, employers, school leaders, healthcare leaders, clergy, et cetera, to come together and say, what can we do locally to contribute to this more global problem? Because if we don't address it in a comprehensive manner, then we're going to stand still where we are today and we're going to look the same or worse 20 years from now.
Well, and in some ways, though, it sounds like the description of Indiana could apply to the states surrounding us, too. Mm-hmm. Do they have the same sort of problems, or is any one of our neighbor states doing a better job with this? Julie, I'll throw that to you.
Well, we know certain states surrounding us are even worse than we are. Kentucky, for instance, I think is the worst in smoking rates. It will come as no surprise that they also have the lowest tobacco tax rate. You know, in the states surrounding us, you know, everybody's going to compare to each other a little bit differently. But I think, you know, to Doug's point, we really have to get to the point where we make this a community effort. And the reason that the chamber has really been so engaged in this is when we think about it, employers are really the common denominator for a lot of people in the communities. And having the employers involved and engaged in these discussions is really so instrumental in making sure that we approach this problem aggressively.
We are talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana. It's an innovative collaboration of basically health, professional, civic leadership organizations here in the state of Indiana to try to move Indiana from the bottom ranks of health and wellness ratings. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Doug Leonard. He is the president of the Indiana Hospital Association, Mike Ripley. He is the Vice President for Healthcare Policy for the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. And Julie Reed. She is the Executive Vice President for the Indiana State Medical Association. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana on No Limits today. My guests are Doug Leonard. He is the president of the Indiana Hospital Association. Mike Ripley, who is vice president for healthcare policy of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. And Julie Reed, who is executive vice president for the Indiana State Medical Association. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Eric has done and send us a message via Facebook. You can find us there at nolimitswfyi. Eric writes, in recent years, Indiana's tobacco settlement funding, money from tobacco companies via lawsuits for illness and death caused by tobacco use, has been moved away from supporting anti-tobacco efforts in the state and instead been put towards non-health-related state expenses via the state legislature. Will the Alliance address this change and, in my opinion, misuse of tobacco cessation-related funding? Doug, I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, that is an unfortunate issue that occurred, and it clearly is one of our agenda to make sure that when we go to the policymakers that we put in place efforts to make this permanent so that the funding that's created here, which can be substantial, will be allocated in the direction that it should go, which is in the cessation and public health issues. So I know, as Mike pointed out, though, there will be debates. Last year, the debate was, do we pass a cigarette tax to increase road funding? That is likely to be something that will be bounced back and forth. But our hope is that this will be directed exactly as we intended.
Gotten another Facebook question from a listener named Christina. She says, I'm surprised that the GOP, who has been the louder proponent of personal responsibility, has not already instituted policies ensuring that people who choose to smoke and choose not to engage with smoking cessation programs must pay for the additional health care costs that they will incur from this behavior. Why protect those engaged in a behavior that so clearly causes harm and increased costs for all? Mike, I'll throw that one to you.
Well, I think the debate, and I've talked to a few legislators on this over the last several years because we've been working on this preferential treatment for about 4 years now. The perspective from the GOP, the Republicans, has historically been they don't want see government intrusion. We think it's just the opposite. We think government has already intruded in the decision-making process for employers. I think the debate also will be individual rights, the individual right to smoke, and that's, as Doug mentioned before, the more libertarian perspective. Again, coming from an employer, while it may be someone's right to smoke, it's our right to make a decision about that employee that does smoke.
Wouldn't it be, and I'm posing the question, obviously, to folks who are doing this, but it also would strike me that part of the libertarian philosophy also would assume that if you exercise your right to do something, it is also your responsibility to bear the costs for that choice. Is that an argument that the Alliance is going to advance? I will throw that one to Julie.
I think that's a fair way to think about it. I mean, the reality is there are really significant costs to not only the smoker themselves, but the people around them, and as we've heard, to the state. And so I think it makes a lot of sense to say if there's cost to that to others, then those costs ought to be borne by the person who is causing other people to incur them, whether it's the state or other people. And so it really is the approach of kind of personal responsibility that you take ownership of those pieces of the costs you cause.
We are talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Matt has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Certainly.
One of the panelists made the comment that the largest health-related cost for employers is related to smoking. And I was curious how that compares to the cost associated with being overweight, whether that be diabetes, obesity treatments, cardiovascular disease. And then what can really be done about that, you know, in light of a very large, organized, and very well-funded lobbying organizations that support the sugar and the beverage industry?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Matt.
Thank you.
So who would like that one? I'll tell you what, I'll throw it to Doug.
Sure. Obesity is clearly a major issue for us. As Mike said, we don't have the numbers for employers on the cost of obesity, but we know obesity itself contributes to type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and certain types of cancer. We know the national numbers that diabetes costs the country between $147 billion and $210 billion each year. And if Indiana ranks 32 in the nation for adult diabetes, we know that it's a substantial cost for it, even though it hasn't been calculated out per se. We know obese employees generate more than 51,000 medical claims per 100 full-time employees. So that's compared to $7,500 for healthy weight workers, driving up health care costs for all employees. So I think you're bringing up sort of one of the other issues in our umbrella effort to address all of these issues. We have focused this year just on the tobacco initiatives. The initiatives related to obesity from a policymaker standpoint aren't as clear as I'm sure you're informed by your question that other states like New York have tried things like taxing sugar drinks, et cetera. And I know those discussions are underway and experiments are underway. Maybe by the time we're able to address that from a policymaker standpoint, there will have emerged some evidence-based strategies that tend to work and stick and help with that very dangerous issue too.
We are talking about the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana here on No Limits. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you.
Certainly.
I heard one of your panelists comment earlier about infant mortality. Mm-hmm. I'm more curious about maternal mortality and other factors. I know that WHO and Guttmacher show that with more restrictive legislation towards reproductive health that there can be issues, and I know, like, for instance, Texas is showing among African-American population there's much more a higher maternal mortality rate. I'm just wondering where Indiana is stacking up.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. We'll see if we can get an answer for you, Melissa. So does anyone have numbers on that? I can see people looking frantically through charts
it's a very critical issue, and we haven't embarked on addressing the questions of, provision of fertility medicines and actions. Though I will say, in the work of the infant mortality work at the state, we've also addressed the issues of the availability of birth control devices, et cetera, for mothers at the time. They're still in the hospital and trying to help arrange for those things to be paid for through Medicaid. And Medicaid's been very responsive to some of those issues. So that touches a little bit on what you're getting at, but we haven't taken that one on as a central theme of this.
How much of this, Melissa, I'm going to take the spirit of your question, I think, too, is also a product of the fact that that there are factors beyond the medical and health questions that touch on many of the, you know, like the with smoking, we're talking about, an assertion of personal individual rights, a fairly extreme interpretation of that. When we talk about reproductive rights and all of that, that's an extremely volatile issue in American culture. How difficult is it to thread the needle and try to talk about the health consequences, the wellness consequences of all of these things that are touched by other concerns or other issues? Julie?
You know, it's terribly challenging, and these are things that the physicians that I work for deal with every single day. And I think, you know, that's the reality of it. That's where those discussions need to occur, is between, you know, the patients and the individual healthcare providers and the other support system that they have in place for themselves. That's where you address those issues. At our level, at this kind of stakeholder organization level, we're really focused on the evidence-based things that we can do. In some ways, it's just to recognize the cost. I think a lot of people would be really surprised that tobacco smoking costs Indiana $6 billion per year. You know, our role is to kind of find the data, bring it to light, make people aware, and address the things that we can do at a policy level that are evidence-based, and then leave some of those personal and social issues to the patients at the patient level with their healthcare providers and the other people they work with.
Doug.
If I can add something, I think it's really important that as we embark on this work, that we're sensitive to the fact that these are not bad people that have chosen to smoke. I grew up in a family of smokers, and fortunately, I just didn't pick it up. It's, you know, just pure luck that I didn't. But I didn't grow up with bad people. I grew up with people that had adopted a habit, and in most cases, they all regretted that they ever picked it up in the first place and wanted to do something about it. So we can't go into this kind of work and being judgmental about the people that are affected by it. What we're trying to do is create an environment where it's less likely that people will start smoking and more likely that they'll quit and more likely that we've created the opportunities for that to happen. So that's an important issue when you get into these things, because when you start to address a person's choice, it almost feels like we're addressing the person, and that isn't our intention.
Gotten a question from a listener named Jennifer via Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Jennifer writes, I recently heard a statistic from the Indiana State Health Insurance Program that 600 Hoosiers are turning 65 every day. Does the Alliance have any initiatives to address the needs of the aging population in Indiana? In particular, I'm interested in comments regarding the concept of aging in place and reducing the need for institutionalization. I'll throw that one first to Doug, or is that a later stage problem?
Yeah, it's not a problem that is in the sort of the boundaries that we've embarked on in addressing these other health areas. It certainly is a reflection of a national societal issue of how do we age in the appropriate place with the right care at the right time, not waste resources, and even to the point of, you know, appropriate use of medical policies and approaches that allow us to age and eventually die with dignity and to have our wishes made known. One of the things that we are working on sort of outside of the boundaries of this is, you know, trying to get a statewide dialogue going about end-of-life issues. And it's an area that I think we need to address more fully, but it's not in the boundaries of what we've embarked on here.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Todd via Facebook. If you want to talk to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Todd writes, most of the problems discussed by the panel would be solved by single-payer health care. However, it has not been mentioned. Mike, you're chortling here.
Yes, from an employer perspective, we could sit and debate this all day. We have not been supportive of a single-payer system. I think what has happened with the Affordable Care Act is clear that the costs related to employers, the nature of the state exchanges that in many states have collapsed and are not doing well, and some of the carriers have exited the market, indicate that before we go down that path, we've got to fix the current system. From an employer perspective, there's a lot of cost shifting that goes on in those kind of programs, and ultimately somebody has to pay for it. If you have a single payer system, It's either going to be – it's the taxpayer is going to end up paying for it, and then you have issues related to access to care and the ability to in terms of timing, in terms of actually obtaining procedures and what have you. So we have some concerns about going down that path, and I don't know about the other two, but this – again, this doesn't really – address the issues that we're trying to go after here with the Alliance.
So let me ask this question, and I'll throw it, I think, probably to Doug first. And that is, what's going to constitute success here? Do you have some mileposts that you expect to hit within a year, within 2 years, within five, that will tell you whether this is working or not?
Sure. There are a couple of metrics that are easily obtained for us, you know, that, and we're working with Fairbanks School of Public Health and using that as our source of sort of a scorecard that we'll develop with the various metrics that are available to us. And the dean, Paul Halverson, has been an integral part of this discussion. So that's where we'll take our measures. And so we're talking about a reduction in teens that start smoking, a reduction in people who are active smokers. Ultimately, the benefit of those things will be a reduction in healthcare spending on smoking and tobacco as an issue. So there are a number of ways that we can measure success on this.
In terms of that, and do you have a target number? I know. I think Mike said we're at 23% of Hoosiers who are smoking right now. Do you want to bring that down to 20 within a few years? What,
go ahead,
Mike?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, our 2025 plan, I believe, I don't have it right in front of me, but I think we identified 15% as the population in total smoking, and so that would be. Putting it back to that would put us in, I think, if I recall, and I'm going to have to go back and look at all these stats, but we would be about average if we went to that point. So 15, I think it's 15% of the total population.
So 15% by 2025?
2025,
so,
yes.
So within 8 years.
Now, that let me say, that is the chamber's goal. That's not, I don't know that that's necessarily the Alliance's goal. That was a specific chamber goal.
Is that a, Julie, I'm going to ask you and let you have the last word here. Is that a realistic goal?
Well, I don't think that we know how quickly the solutions are going to yield the results. What we know is that the strategies do work. What we know is they're a good start. We'll start with the numbers we've got, the $1.50 tax increase, raising the age. We know those will have an immediate impact. If they don't have enough of an impact, then we'll talk about what other strategies we need to do, including how we spend those tobacco prevention and cessation funds that are out there. I think at the end of the day, we can all say that we would be most proud of our state if we became number one in the country, and we can aspire to be that eventually.
And I think that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Doug Leonard, Mike Ripley, and Julie Reed. Also like to thank our listeners for some great questions. Invite everybody back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about holiday cooking. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.